In October 2021, Gideon Dada received a message from a recruiter on LinkedIn. The recruiter was looking to hire someone to join the team at Metis Capital and felt he would be a good fit. After a round of assessments and interviews, he got the job, resuming in December 2021. On this episode of Equity Merchants, he shares his journey and some thoughts on investments in Africa. So, first question, how long have you been working in VC now?
I think I started formally in December 2021, so about 5 months there about now.
5 months. Oh, that's cool. So how did you get into venture capital? What were you doing before now?
Okay, so I'll speak to what I was doing before now, then I'll speak to how I got into VC. So prior to this, I worked at an asset management firm called Sankore. So Sankore is like an asset management and wealth management firm. While at Sankore, I helped out with the wealth management team, helped to optimize the wealth management process, and also helped with a bit of trade settlement, some valuations, and all of that. So I had a year with asset management. Fast forward to, I think, October last year. Then a member of the team where I work reached out to me on LinkedIn. Actually, she first checked my LinkedIn profile and she's like, oh, hi, I'm hiring for this role. Heard you're super smart and all of that. you want to take a look at the JD? So I just looked through and it looked pretty interesting. So I put in my application. They sent over some assessments. Oh, work on this deal log. What would you change with this? How would you source for deals? Due diligence as well and all of that. And so we had an agreement around December last year. So that's how I got into VC.
Okay. So you had like a good job in asset management. So why did you make the move? Were you looking at something? Were you looking at making a move into VC?
That's an interesting question. So let me just give a brief background of the persons I work with or where I'm working right now. So actually, I work with a family office, the Bello Osage family office. It is called Metis Capital. All right. And then I don't know if you know Bello Osage, but he's, you know, a popular, affluent person in Nigeria, across the world, actually. Forbes, among the richest Africans, rated by Forbes and all of that. And so the opportunity to work with his children now, Yasmin and Junaid. So Yasmin, ex-McKinsey, founder of She Leads Africa, you know. Junaid as well, ex-McKinsey, currently chief of staff at Flutterwave. So pretty much for me, it was the opportunity to work with these guys and learn from them. No doubt, I had a good job doing asset management, learning a lot, a structured, much more structured environment, you know, gaining accolades and all of that. But when the opportunity came to learn from these guys that have this consulting background, I just felt like it was the perfect opportunity for me at that time. And to be honest, I mean, between when I started in December and now, it's been nothing short of my expectation.
Okay, that's impressive. Okay, so let's backtrack a bit. So you were sort of headhunted for the role. What qualities will you say made you stand out, or like what qualities helped you get in?
Sort of headhunted. You know, when I think about it again, I think my brother actually played a role as well. I can't remember if Yasmin already reached out to my brother and then he put in a word for me. All right. Okay. But like, the only point I remember now is her reaching out and saying, hiring for this role, would you be interested? You know, so I didn't put in any application from my end. So I don't know what might have gone down in the background and stuff like that. But I think, she knows my brother. And then they're not so close, but I know she knows my brother. That's Benjamin. So what qualities would I say made me a good fit for this role? So first, I think responsibility. All right. Okay. So I work remotely. All right. It's a family office. So pretty much I lead conversations on the VC aspects, you know, like I'm the only analyst stroke associate on the team. I use the word interchangeably. All right. But like I lead efforts on the VC team. So you want someone that you're not running after on Monday morning or even midnight on Friday. Like if you need something, you want to know that, oh, this person is available. And then, you know, just being responsible, taking responsibility for your task, and then being someone that they can being someone that they can be rest assured that you would perform on your task. Aside that, I think my profile on LinkedIn just shows my track record of experiences so far. So right from 200 level, I've always had a what I call a white collar job while studying. Yeah, it's been a lot, you know, like from 200 level I've had, like even while studying, so 200 right up until when I finished school, I had a job on the side. And so that just shows the ability to manage your time and then also deliver on.
So what did you study?
I studied accounting, you know.
Okay.
Studied accounting, worked on the side, finished my first class degree, also served as chairman student body on campus at Covenant University. So I think that just communicates that responsibility mentality or quality in a person. So I think responsibility, intellectual curiosity, you know, I've gone out to take some certification exams, acquired certificates across different sectors in finance as well, you know. I think those two things, man, if you want to be responsible, someone that's responsible, someone that's smart as well. And then, yeah, pretty much.
All right. So you came from an asset management background and now you're in VC. Are there like similarities between what you do?
The asset management firm I worked at, I know we actually even had some VC investments, but at the time I know that the MD invested in Shuttlers, and I don't know if you know Shuttlers.
Yeah.
All right. But like that was not a conversation for the company to have. So just, you know, sort of a personal conversation. But some way, somehow I got wind of that conversation, you know. And so that was the only relatable aspect between my current job and my work at asset management. Working asset management was much more structured, much more laid down rules that you're following. Oh, we want to settle this trade, T plus two, we're reaching out to custodians and all of that. So it was just more about doing the basics over and over and over again. You know, for someone like me that enjoys new challenges, it can get boring at some point, you know.
Yeah.
And then, so coming to VC, it's much more flexible. You don't look through the same deck twice, all right? So today you're looking at something in Bitcoin wallet infrastructure. The next day you're looking at data infrastructure. The next day you're looking at fintech, lending, credit products. You're looking at different things, man. And for all of these things, all of these opportunities that you come across, you have to go out to get the knowledge, so at least you know what questions you're asking the founders, and at least understand the product rigorously before you can even make a decision. So it's not so similar, I would say, between asset management and venture capital. You know, venture capital, you still that bit of intuition. Asset management, except only when you're trading bonds and then you're thinking, oh, I expect this bond to rise, I expect this bond to drop, oh, let's sell, let's buy. That's the only intuitive part. But every other thing is structured. You use the same models to value bonds, and the same, you have the same templates that you have to follow. So it's quite different.
All right. Okay, so let's talk about your day-to-day as an analyst slash associate now. So what's your day-to-day like? What do you do?
Good question. So I think I start my day by going to the gym. You know, like I said, I work remotely. All right. And then according to my contract, I'm to work 9 to about 6 p.m., which definitely might not be the case at all times. All right. But like day to day, I think I wake up at about 7 a.m., 7:30. I'm at the gym between 7:30 and 9 a.m. Just, you know, start the day sharp and, you know, come back, take a shower and then get to my desk. Early task would be, you know, looking through my mails, what came in over the night, what am I to deliver on that morning. Do I have any calls between 9 and 12, which is unlikely though, except when we're speaking to guys in, you know, Hong Kong and different time zones where, you know, somebody has to take the call in the morning. It's either your evening time or their morning time. All right. So between 9 and 12, checking up on my meals. And yeah, just actioning whatever needs to be actioned. And then checking on what I need to send before certain deadlines in the day. And then so between 12 and 4, 12 and 6, meetings, back to back. So aside the fund that we have and, you know, invest in startups, we're also raising a fund on the other hand. All right. So we're also having investors calls. We're having, you know, we have to go work on their feedback. So it's a lot of CRM, relationship management, calls, sending follow-ups and all of that. So you can imagine that I have about 5-6 calls a day. All right, so within 12 and 6, I just take calls and then try and work on the feedback from those calls during the day. Between 6 and 7:30, I just try to take a step back to breathe, which is very important because you can have as many calls as possible, but then like you need time to also work on these things that you've identified. All right, so between 6 and 7:30, I might take a nap for 30 minutes. Just to wake up refreshed, work on something else for an hour because there's always something to work on. I can't just start going into details because I work the family office, all right? So there is the VC bit. So on the VC side, we have a seed fund that, you know, invests small tickets in burgeoning startups across the continent. That's on the left-hand side. On the right-hand side, we have a massive fund we are raising. I'm not allowed to go into details right now, but it's going to be one of the largest funds in the continent, all right? So, like, it's a lot of investors' relations on that side, you know, securing our anchor and all of that. So we also have calls on that side. And then outside VC, I also have some other family office duties, like financial services, because there are about 4 work streams. I also handle financial services. I help out with some other investments that we've done prior to all these funds. And you can imagine that, founders are calling and all of that. So it's a lot. So within 6 and 7:30, I just try to put some structure around whatever I've done during the day. Between 7:30 and 9 again, I'm back at the gym. I actually go to the gym a lot. I'm back at the gym between 7:30 and 9, the gym just refreshes my mind. Prior to this call, I just took a shower because I just got back from the gym. I'm at home, I'm sitting down all day, you know. So morning session, I just try to do some cardio, and then evening session, I try to lift as well. And so when I come back by 9:30 or 9 p.m., take a shower again, and then now I'm ready to hit it harder. So it is between 9:30 and 12, 1, 2, that I do the research, all right? Because there's also that bit of research. You're working on investments memo. You're working on those, looking for leads for our fund that we are raising. Oh, we're going through this list. Who are we speaking to? Who was referenced in this article? Who do we want to speak to in this company? How can we get this email? So I do my research between 9:30 and 1 a.m., 2 a.m. I work at night, like not out of compulsion, all right, but I'm sharper at night. There's no email coming in, or at least I can ignore whatever is coming in because I'm not under compulsion. So that 12 a.m. is my time to, you know, work on research and then do personal stuff. Like I said, I still take certifications right now. I'm taking McKinsey's Forward program. I'm reading for CFA. You know, things like that. So I just do my stuff middle of the night. And then again, I wake up at 7:30 to go to the gym. So pretty much.
So how many deals do you reject in a week?
In a week? Actually, before this call, I just quickly looked through the deal log that I've been managing since about January. All right, and now I think I've looked at about 50 decks between January, yeah, and April 26th, about 50. All right. How many have we invested in? I think 4. You know, how many did we like? We liked about 8, 9, 10. So that's about 25%. So I'm thinking 1 out of every 4 would be really interesting for us. But because of budgetary restrictions, you know, it's still a new space. Like, there's no professional investor on the team. So we're still taking it easy. All right. We give out just small tickets between 10 to 25K. All right. And then just take it easy and then bring in our value that we're adding to the investors. So the investors are, you know, even looking forward to having us on their cap table than our ticket sizes. So we've been interested in about 10 of them. We've passed on about 4 to other angels that we're in contact with, you get. And then, yeah, invested in 4. So let's say 10% of what we've received is what we've invested in.
Okay, so what's the investment thesis at Metis Capital?
Well, first, we're sector agnostic. Get. So, like, we look at everything and anything. All right. Second, we like to invest in companies where we think we can add substantial value. And so we're more particular about value add. So how can we support this product or this company? You know, what are we bringing to the table? So, like, definitely we've done a couple of fintech deals. Because we have experience in that space. Our chairman, all right, has been in the space for 40 plus years. So chairman of the board of Etisalat, UBA, currently the largest shareholder of FSDH, you know. So like the finance space and then helping out with regulatory bits is our forte, if you get what I mean. And then we also look to help guys that are establishing outside Nigeria but also looking to penetrate the Nigerian markets. So one of the companies we invested in, Garage, is an automobile product or startup, you know, looking to come into the Nigerian space, help capture market share and all of that. So thesis is basically we look at everything and anything. At least we take it through our pipeline. We'd like to invest in companies that we think we can add substantial value. If it is help with regulators, if it is to penetrate Nigerian markets, if it's just our experience, because the team is really experienced. Like I said, our chairman has 40 plus years operating on the continent. Yasmin has grown a platform that she leads Africa. To about 750,000 women on the continent. Junaid as your chief of staff at Flutterwave, you know. So like there's that massive value that we can bring to whatever company we choose to invest in. You find that when companies actually do their due diligence, they come back to us and are saying, oh, whatever ticket size you're looking at, we're happy to have on our cap table, even if it is less than the minimum ticket. So yeah, we look at anything and anything and then we try to ensure that we are adding value to whatever companies are investing in.
All right. So what sectors excite you the most?
Let me think about this. So when I think of sectors that excite me, I think first is fintech, all right? And then, especially because there's still a lot of white space for growth, transactions in Africa is still predominantly in cash, with about 95% cash transactions. So we've only been able to digitize 5%. So like, that's still a lot of opportunity for other startups to come on board and actually take hold of this opportunity, you know, bank the unbanked persons and actually get them to digitize payments. All right, and that's just for payments alone. So outside payments, there's credits. You know, when payment is sorted, it is easier to credit score people. That's for creditors now. Also give out loans, and also collection won't be an issue because payment has been sorted, you know, outside payment as well. There's savings, there's insurance and what have you. So payments is just like that background for the other layers that are still embedded in fintech. And outside fintech, I think health tech as well. So the advent of COVID just made us understand that, you know, the way we are moving, or we were moving, isn't the way to go. Having to go to hospitals, queue for hours, and then, you know, just to seek basic attentions of medical personnel, it wasn't cutting it at all. So we are seeing advent in health tech as well, seeing EMR systems coming in to also take off some burden of the nurses. We're seeing different logistics platforms that are helping with drugs delivery, you know, blood bank and all of that. So I think health tech is also super exciting. And then the last would be around e-commerce. I see a future where most of what most of the basic necessities, talking about groceries and all of that, would be delivered to our doorsteps. All right, already, mm-hmm. I've received an opportunity, or received a deck where they are looking to make distribution of certain products, you know, edible oil, detergent and all of that, much easier and seamless. So instead of having them packaged from the manufacturing industry or manufacturing plants, we can actually deliver them wholesale to the retailers, where persons just, you know, come around with their containers and all of that and just refill, just as you would do with petrol for your car. So that, you know, reduces manufacturing cost about 35%, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. Which is very exciting for me. You know, after you buy a bottle of granite oil, you just throw away the bottle, you convert it to something else in your house and all of that. But now you have to actually keep your bottles. Perfect example is, you know, like water dispensers. Exactly. So that would be like a model that they're looking to adopt for a variety of products. So in summary, I'm thinking fintech, health tech, and then e-commerce, pretty much.
All right. Okay, so more money is coming into the African ecosystem. Like we had last year where over almost $5 billion was raised by African startups. And of course, Nigeria took home most of that money. Do you think that VC funding is for everybody? And what kind of investor or what kind of entrepreneur or business should stay away from VC money?
That's a very interesting question. Do I think VC money is for everybody? And then what types of, what kinds of entrepreneurs should stay away from VC? Yeah. Well, off the top of my head, I'm thinking if you're a bad communicator, or you don't do well with feedback, and then, you know, just keeping persons posted, you should stay away from accepting persons' money or investors' money, because whoever is investing wants to know how his funds are faring, you know, as often as possible, or at least they just have an idea of when to expect an update. So you find founders actually sending out updates monthly or bi-monthly, or worst case scenario ideally should be quarterly. all right. But you find that some founders are just, you know, super reluctant to send out figures and all of that. Definitely, they can hire some person or a team that's in charge of investor relations and all of that. But first, I'm thinking if you're a bad communicator, stay away from collecting VC money. Second, I'm thinking if it's not your full-time job, if you're not committing 100% to the product that you're building, stay away from collecting VC money. I mean, during due diligence as well, it would come up like, oh,
okay,
what else are you doing? Like, it doesn't work for us. I wouldn't invest in you if you're not committing your 100% to this, because like, why won't you commit your 100% to this? It's already a red flag for an investor. Like, this should be, we want to see that total commission, and then also want to know that like, you have something to lose. It just communicates how much that product or that idea, yeah, how much it means to you. All right, so if you're not looking to commit 100% to whatever you're building, stay away from collecting investors' money as well. What else? Yeah, I mean, I think everything just layers on commitment, you know, going the extra mile, because VC money, definitely investors know it is high risk, all right, but as an entrepreneur, you have to make sure you do your best to minimize that risk for the investor. Definitely, or if anything happens, they are like preferred creditors, they get their money first and all of that. But more than the money, they want returns. So as the entrepreneur, you have to be ready to go the extra mile. You have to be ready to do whatever it takes. You have to be ready to manage as well the resources within your reach, like to make sure you're not burning so much, you're not having to raise bridge and all of that because of having high burn rates with no particular returns in mind, you know. So you can have a high burn rate at some point because you expect that your revenue after that period would efficiently cover for it, but like, you don't want to waste money, you don't want to, so you want to be resourceful. So just to summarize, I'm thinking, if you're not ready to communicate properly, stay from collecting VC money. If you're not looking to commit 100% to the idea or the product, stay away from collecting VC money. And then, yeah, if you're not ready to go the extra mile, if you're not ready to be prudent with your resources at hand, even though you understand that VCs are taking a gamble, all right, stay away from VC money as well. Because, you know, when you're reviewing early stage deals, you're looking at, oh, who is the founder? What has he built? Where has he worked? You know, education, where did he school? Just to like have an idea of how rigorous or how much he would be able to put into this company, you know, the network he has and all of that. So it's very important that you're resourceful as a founder with VC money. So those three things for me.
All right. Okay, so you just mentioned qualities that you would look out for when you're making an investment. So as a founder, so let's just say you're not in VC now, but like a founder, so what qualities or what should founders ask themselves before wanting a specific investor on their cap table?
What should founders ask themselves before looking to bring in a specific investor? Well, I think you have to be strategic about how you compose your cap table. If you're looking for large tickets strictly, you know who to talk to. All right, you have international institutions that are coming in now with fat check sizes, you get. If you're looking for support and value add, you know you're speaking to persons that have experience on the ground. So if your niche market or if your For Africa now, you're looking for a person that have experience working in that space, and they can also help you with some intros and network to just make your life easier, you know. So first, that's be strategic. You want to know what you need at a particular point. Definitely, if you're raising 2 million, you can have a mix of all of that. So you can raise about 1.5 from large VC firms, institutions, A16, Tencent, and the likes. But you also want to have some local players that can help you, that are ready to help you on the ground as well. So if I'm a founder, I'm looking to just have a perfect mix of large ticket sizes and then investors with lots of value add in different sectors. I don't know if that answers your question perfectly.
I think it does. Okay, so we've had issues with a few startup founders, and a lot of it has bothered about either cultures in these places or probably corporate governance. So what role do you think investors can play, especially when we consider that the African tech space is really nascent? Most of our most successful companies are all under 10 years. So it's not like we have a lot of experience to draw on. So what role do you think investors can play or should play in ensuring that there's like a healthy culture and that there's corporate governance in these startups?
I think the question of culture, the topic of culture, just came under spotlight with the happenings in the past couple of months. All right.
Yeah.
And so for an investor, it's definitely not good PR for you, neither is it good for your expected returns, because these things affect revenue, affect perception of the continent to persons that are looking from the outside. What can an investor do to help with the culture?
Yeah.
Well, so for investors, first, we want to have information about your need. You know, so this has not been an issue before or prior to this time. So for investors, for these companies in question, probably they have, training platforms. They have persons that they can reach out to, because I feel like this question of culture can be solved largely by training. You know, so people just like to believe that this is not a topic, or you just expect that these things don't happen or shouldn't happen. So I think proper sensitization of even grown employees, like experienced folks out there as well, it's very, very important. And just hammering on these things continuously help with that consciousness for employees. So for an investor, I'm thinking help with training programs and sensitization and awareness for things like this. I mean, a small percentage of persons might claim, oh, they don't know that, oh, they are being abusive, probably due to background and stuff like that. I don't buy some of these arguments though, but I think after you have been trained and sensitized of how we would expect employees in companies that we've invested in to behave, all right, I don't know that you still have such excuses. So sensitization and training for employees, I know that might not really apply to founders, because they are looking, or they would look like persons that organize these things, so they might look excluded. But I think for founders, it should be more around regular follow-up and check-up calls with founders, asking them, oh, how is it over there? How is it with the culture? How are employees feeling? You know, from investors' updates as well, which I'd expect investors would receive. They're looking at employee turnover as well. So you might have an idea of how the culture is. So if you think there's a problem actually from the outside, you can actually go the next step by speaking to employees in the company, like, yo man, how is it going over here? What's the issue? You might not even go as an investor, just to have an understanding, and then you can bring these things up with the founder. Because once you've collected the investor's money, you are no longer the only owner of the company, if you get what I mean. So like you are responsible to certain persons as well. So investors can definitely call up founders and be like, yo man, we're not happy with what is happening. How can we help fix these things? If it is within, if it is outside your purview or outside what you can help with, how can we come in? Do you want us to send your guys for trainings? Do you want us to put in some sort of structure, you know? And so how can we help? How can we help? So just to, in two sentences, I think proper training and sensitization for the employees, I think investors definitely can help with that. Like I mentioned on our team, we have the founder of She Leads Africa, you know, so they help with this female empowerment programs and initiatives, over 750 women across the continent. So as part of that initiative, they have trainings and programs like this, all right? So I think that would help employees. So for founders, I think constantly having the conversation with founders and then offering to help, you know, if you're not getting so much from founders, you want to speak to employees as well. Oh, how is it? And then if there's anything that has to actually be taken up legally, I think investors can definitely step in. But that's why the board is obviously part of a team. So during board meetings and all of that, these things will be addressed. So just shining the spotlight helps a great deal. And then everybody will sit up.
All right. Okay. So final question before we leave. The VC world is kind of closed to a lot of people. Not so many understand or even know what happens. So what's the biggest misconception that people outside the investment world have about what you do?
The VC world is closed towards a lot of people. Well, that's because it is relatively new, and so opportunities are not as advertised as an opening in maybe a bank or, you know, a factory and stuff like that. What's the biggest misconception? The biggest misconception that's coming to mind now is that you have to have it all figured out before going into investment, like, or going into VC. You might not understand it, or you might not know everything before you start investing. You know, like I said, it's when you come across these deals, all right, that you then take that step to actually learn about these things. Like right now, I'm working on a memo for a blockchain wallet infrastructure company. Like, blockchain is not my area of expertise. I'm a finance guy, but like, this has just dragged me out of that comfort zone to actually learn about these things. Same as well for data infrastructure and stuff like that. So you don't have to have it all figured out before you come into VC. You can learn as well with your team, all right? Take calculated guesses, reach out to persons that might have better understanding of these things. And then, yeah, there's also the follow-on effect, something like the bandwagon effect. So if you don't even really understand, you can just ask the investor, let me see your cap table, who has invested. So if you are seeing a person that you respect in the space, say it's a music opportunity, and you're saying, oh, Mr. Easy has invested, Emma Abaga has invested, you know, guys that you expect that would understand these businesses and that are in this space, you get, you can take some comfort from that while you still continue your due diligence. So the biggest misconception would be that, oh, you have to have it all figured out or be super smart or know some certain persons and all of that before you come in. It's not entirely true. It's not entirely true. But once you are in, you have to network aggressively to even get deal flow. You have to even network even more to reach out persons to understand whatever decks you're looking at and also do your personal research.
Okay.
I think that's it for me.
All right. So I know I said last question, but what would you say to a final year student who is looking at venture capital and is like, okay, maybe
this is something I might like. What do you tell the person to do to prepare for an opportunity in venture capital?
What would I tell the final year students? Well, I would say you should network. Like, the importance of networking and reaching out and then just being a person of value can't be overemphasized in this business, because in most cases, the opportunities are just for one person or two people at maximum, you know. And the person that is recruiting is not, it's not an HR personnel. It's actually probably a partner or an investor that just needs someone to work with him. So he does not have time to start looking for your WAEC results and asking which primary school could you go to. So they just want to know, oh, what have you done to show your interest in this space? All right. What deals do you know of? And then what can you say about these deals? All right. And then third would probably be around what value are you bringing to the team? You know, are you a responsible person? Like, you want to communicate all of these things within 10 minutes of conversation with this person, like, and without the person even asking you these questions. So, you know, I've been in conversations, I've been at hangouts with persons in the space, and within 5 minutes, 10 minutes, they're asking me, oh, do you know where you are? Are you looking to play what? You get what I'm trying to say? Like, within 5 to 10 minutes. And from that, you're not going to go back to say, oh, send me your CV or send me your reference and stuff like that. Nah, that's not how it happens in this space. You just want to be able to communicate that value you're bringing within 5 to 10 minutes. All right. So, like, just yearn for knowledge, be in the know of what's happening in the space, and whatever opportunity you have to network with these persons, grab it with both hands, man. Even if you have to pay for these conferences and all of that. But pretty much, that's my advice for persons looking to penetrate the space.
All right. Thank you so much, Gideon, for your time. This has been a very interesting conversation. So thank you so much.
Thank you for joining me today on the podcast. But before we go, a few things. Please share and like this episode. You can also catch up with previous episodes at equitymerchants.show.